and welcome to Autistically Unapologetic, the unfiltered and unmasked podcast about everything autism. Here's your host, Devin Morrissey.
Hi, and welcome to Autistically Unapologetic with me, Devin Morrissey. I would like to officially welcome you all to episode 23, where today I will be continuing the conversation about being autistic and overcoming adversity. Now, as we go through Autism Awareness and Acceptance Month, it's important to note that autism is found in all different parts of the country and the world, such as different genders, races, politics, and even sexualities. My next guest is an out and proud representative who showcases his own unique way of being autistic. He is an actor, singer, and stand-up comedian who is here today to share his work about his life being both gay and autistic. Please welcome to Autistically Unapologetic, George Steves. George, welcome to the podcast, my friend.
Hi.
Listen, I am so elated that you're here. Thank you for taking the time out of your already busy schedule right now to do this. I've been not only impressed by your talent, but I've also been impressed by the way that you carry out your life and how you live your life, being so authentic and so unapologetically yourself. So George, usually when I have a guest, particularly an autistic guest, comes on, I kind of like to start at the very beginning of the journey. When were you first diagnosed autistic? When did you first find out that you were autistic? And what was your reaction to all of it?
Well, it's quite a story, actually. I have a couple of jokes I say in my stand-up, which is I had Asperger's before it was canceled. Because, you know, Dr. Hans Asperger was a Nazi, so now we can't use that anymore. It's like, I'm sorry, that's what it was referred to the entire time I was growing up. There's nothing I could do about that. And the other joke I say is I had Asperger's before it was trendy. Because here's the thing, I grew up in the 1990s, and bear in mind, I grew up in rural Virginia. I was blessed to have the kind of parents I had who luckily had a lot of patience and were ready and equipped for something like this, because there was a pediatrician who did flat out tell both my parents, if your son had a different set of parents, he might have been dead by now. So, yeah, just because not everybody can handle an autistic child who repeats the same thing over and over and over again, and especially in the rural South. So, yeah, it could have gone a whole different way if I had had an entirely different set of parents. And yes, I found that out recently because my mother revealed that at a Q&A we were having for my documentary at my home state, but more on that later. Yeah, my mother revealed that one like to an audience, and I was like, my mother always does that. She always has stories that even I don't know. And it's like, wow.
Oh. Our parents, though, they always feel like they can just blurt out random stories or stuff from our past. And we're just like, did you ask us first before you could share that information?
And it's like stuff that I didn't even know. Like, wow, I had no idea. A pediatrician from Virginia flat out said that to my parents. Had no idea. But so the thing was, growing up in rural Virginia, I didn't get a later diagnosis. I actually didn't get my official diagnosis until I was 11. And by that point, my family had moved to Pennsylvania. And the thing was, in Virginia, I had an IEP. Originally, they were thinking it was pervasive developmental disorder. There was a possibility of ADHD. And I got that diagnosis right along with Asperger's as well, ADHD. And because usually those two got diagnosed hand in hand. I have a lot of jokes about it in my stand-up where I go, because here's the funny thing. I jokingly say, here's what the gay autistic boy experience is like in the 90s. Just swap trains for Disney princesses. Same thing. Because the joke I like to say is my autism and my gayness kind of went hand in hand. They helped me talk because there was a period when I was 3 years old. You would ask me any question under the sun and all I could say was Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. And that really just should have given my parents the first inkling right there at three. Yeah, probably not going to be heterosexual. Not going to happen. And hey, I did try for a very long time to be straight. I do want to go on the record. I held out till 27 trying to be straight. I was a late bloomer in a lot of ways.
Oh, wow.
Late bloomer socially, late bloomer sexually. So yeah, my mother told me, because I asked her about it years later, you know, why was I diagnosed so late? Because most boys get diagnosed at 3 and 4. And then one of the jokes I like to say is, I think if I had gone to the doctors and just said trains, they would have said autism right away. But because I said Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, they had no idea what to do with that. They were like, maybe it's not autism. Maybe he's just really gay. How I found out the first time that I was different officially, and it was kind of a traumatic experience. I mean, I did always sense when I was growing up as a child that I was a little weird or off or different from everybody else. I think every child can kind of sense that they don't always fit in, or, you know, and I certainly had my share of bullies and getting teased like most children do growing up. And I wasn't immune to any of that growing up. When I first found out I was different was, so my family moved to Pennsylvania in 2000 when I was in the fifth grade. We had left Virginia. When we left Virginia, I had had an IEP, but the beauty was I went to a school called Woodland Academy. Woodland Academy was a really small school. We're talking like 8 to 12 kids per grade. Small.
Whoa. So
they were able to treat me like a regular student. I was in class with all my peers and classmates. I maybe got special accommodations, like getting to go outside into the hallway to test during like standardized testing growing up. But, you know, and I had an IEP, but that was, I was still in, there wasn't a special education program at Woodland, and Woodland was luckily accommodating enough where the class sizes were small enough. I was treated like a regular student. If I had gone through the public school system in Virginia, it probably would have been a nightmare. So Woodland was luckily accommodating enough. It was the only game in town that would basically treat me like a regular student. The Virginia public school system wouldn't have been as good for me in the 90s. And I had to go to speech therapy when I was a kid because I used to say all my TH sounds like F when I was a kid. So instead of saying throw, I would say throw it away. So I had to go to speech therapy classes when I was a kid. I had impediments.
Ain't that the truth?
Yep. And that was the that was the best rural Virginia had for resources for kids on the spectrum in the 1990s was speech therapy classes. That was the best they could do. It was, you know, it was interesting growing up ahead of the curve. You know, now the kids who have autism today are so much more blessed because now there's so much more
beyond
awareness and resources and stuff. It's like, wow, I grew up in the last generation, the 1990s, the last generation where it was like before internet and limited resources on what was available and around, and especially in areas like where I was, which was rural Virginia in the 90s. So, but God love my parents. They still did the best with the resources they had. But by the time I got to Pennsylvania, I didn't want to go to a private school. I didn't like Woodland Academy enough to continue doing private school education. So I wanted to give public school a try, and we were going to a good school district. But then I found out, I went to my school district's elementary school, Fort Washington Elementary, to finish out my fifth grade with the regular, you know, kids, a regular class. But then I found out I was going to a different middle school. I wasn't going to go to Sandy Run Middle School, which was the middle school in my district. I was being shipped off to Cedarbrook, and I kept begging and pleading to get out of it, but the answer was no. And then I found out in the fall of 2000, when I was going into the sixth grade, that I was put in a class that was called the IU, which stood for the Intermediate Unit, which was Montgomery County's placement for children who were severely autistic.
Oh, wow.
And because I was high functioning, I shouldn't have been there in the first place. But because it was 2000, the school district kind of panicked and thought, well, he's going to struggle in mainstream, so this is where we should put him. Now, luckily, it wasn't like I was trapped in that classroom all day. I want to give shout out and credit to my teacher, Mrs. Rash. I mean, when I got there, she realized I was high functioning. It's like, okay, I basically got to go out and be in regular classes and get graded like a regular student. So for all the classes, I basically got to go out in sixth and seventh grade and audit other classes and just basically go to first through seventh period or eighth period classes. And just, you know, I made the most of the sticky situation. And then, you know, after seventh grade, I didn't want to do a third year. And then by the time I got into eighth grade, then I was finally put back in like a regular student under learning support, which is where I really should have been the whole time. When I got my psychologist test evaluations years later in 2007, because I was applying to all these colleges and they wanted proof and documentation of my disability, the doctor who did the tests and evaluations told me And this is when I was 19. This is 2007. She said, what happened to you 7 years ago, first of all, shouldn't have happened to you, and it wouldn't have happened to you today.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many more books about it now. There's such a higher awareness to it. Yeah, you got the raw end of the stick. And even when I came back, because life came full circle, I came back when I was a senior in 2007, when I was 18. This was before my 19th birthday. Still mm-hmm. in high school at this point. I was in my fall community college semester when I was applying to colleges to transfer for the following year out here in Southern California. When I came back, I taught drama to Mrs. Resch's current students. And when she was telling her current students that I used to be a student of hers, people were shocked. And
really?
Yeah. And Mrs. Resch even went as far as saying, she was like, you know what? I think he would have been fine without us. My whole life changed drastically in 1 year. In 1 year, mm-hmm. I went from Virginia to Pennsylvania, private school to public school.
Gosh.
Thinking I was a regular student to learning I was not a regular student at all, and that I was considered this by my system. That was very traumatic to go through all of that within 1 year.
That is absolutely wild. I can't even imagine even going into that position that you were in and having that society, or having society in general, literally just confine you into just one small box, say, this is your place in life, and that's how it's always going to be. And that is not, thank God, that's not how it is now. But for people that grew up like us in the 1990s and the 2000s, people do not fully realize that we were literally just trying to get the word about autism even just out there for people to know about. I will say, though, in your particular case about the whole Disney princess thing, that is...
I mean, I'll confess something. I'm a grown
that
adult.
That was funny as heck, man. But anyways.
Yeah, to this day, every now and even when I'm cleaning something, I'm still singing, oh, sing sweet nightingale. I'm still singing that to this day every time I clean something.
Yeah, and I was and beyond. And it's funny because I was just thinking about this the other day, because trains are pretty much an autistic thing. It's a no-brainer.
You see, what's kind of funny was trains, that was one of the autism things. I just never, trains never, it was cars when I was a kid. I loved cars. I could collect those toy cars and I would memorize the year, the model, the make, all the information about it. I loved cars. Trains just missed that one all entirely. My cousin was more into Thomas the Tank Engine than I was.
I mean, Thomas the Tank Engine is the GOAT. We gotta just leave it at that. But it will. But in your world, it's the Disney princesses that are the GOATs, I can imagine.
Before it graduated to like PBS with like Barney and Sesame Street and, you know, Lamb Chops. Because yes, when they had Sherry Lewis and the Lamb in color when we were kids.
We had some wild stuff back in the day. We really had some wild stuff back in the day. Now, George, you are an actor, singer, songwriter, and comedian who has never been afraid to push the boundaries in all autistic-related topics, as well as general life topics. What got you started in wanting to pursue a career in the entertainment industry?
When I went through middle school in Pennsylvania, when I went through high school, I mean, I knew ever since I was a kid I wanted to be in show business. Like most children of the 1990s, I grew up watching Nickelodeon and Disney Channel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up, you know, wanting to be on, you know, TV and be in the movies. I'm going to say this during my SAG Awards speech one day if I ever get the opportunity to do that opening in the beginning. But I'm going to go. In 1994, there was an earth-shattering, groundbreaking movie that came out that made me want to be an actor. That movie was called The Little Rascals. I'm George Steves and I'm an actor. Because that's the honest to God truth. I watched that movie as a kid and I was like, well, that looks like fun. I want to be in movies one day. Now, here's the thing. I will say this. I'm glad I didn't have parents that pushed for the whole child star thing.
Yes.
I'm glad that, I mean, you watch all the documentaries now, like Quiet on the Set, and now they have one called Hollywood Demons, where they just did a whole episode about child actors. And
really?
They get one from different every era. They have, like, the Family Ties guy. They have the, you know, Hughley's guy. They talk about Orlando Brown. I mean, they just get kind of one from different era just to show you how it's, like, the dysfunction can start, you know, at home, but then Hollywood can just make it worse. I'm one of the few actors where, thanks to Instagram, and if I get your number, I will try to stay in touch with actors, but it's hard. We're all traveling circuses and we all move on to the next thing. So I'm glad I didn't have that, but I grew up doing school play after school play and just wanting to, I was like, okay, when the minute I can do this, you know, I'm going to, when I graduate high school, I'm going to go to LA and hit the ground running. My parents, of course, wanted me to go to college. So we did the compromise, which was I went to college in LA. I went to Cal Lutheran up in Thousand Oaks in Ventura County. So just basically the next county up. You know, I hit the ground running right away. I did the whole college thing for a year. I got bored with it. And then after that, I joined an acting class. I started going out on auditions. I started self-submitting. And it's been quite a journey. I mean, I got tapped hard lead into a SAG new media project when I was still in college. So I became eligible to join Screen Actors Guild by 2011. So by that point, I've been in town 3 years. So that was pretty cool to get that already 3 years in. The acting class I was in for 5 years turned out to be a cult. If anybody wants to Google Gloria Gifford, Hollywood Reporter, I was one of the 20 students who spoke out. I was with an acting teacher who was a Scientologist, and she was a malignant narcissist who was very abusive. And get this for all of your listeners. She tried to convince me that I didn't have autism just because I showed emotion. And apparently because I could show emotion, my autism was cured. I didn't have autism. And it's like, no, I can show emotion better now because I've been trained as an actor, but you know, still, hey, autism comes in. We can be emotional too. That's a stereotype when people say that we're all just, you know, people who walk around with monotone voices.
Yep.
And, you know, that's another stereotype about autism that drives me crazy. When people think that that's all autism is monotone and emotionless. And it's just, so yeah, she was a malignant narcissist though. And I spoke out against that abuse. After I left Gloria's class after 5 years, I went to the Groundlings, and I was like many people who go to the Groundlings. I was hoping to rise through the program and get on Saturday Night Live. But then that didn't happen, of course. And unfortunately, like many actors, COVID slowed down my momentum completely, and it's been a struggle to get it back. But, you know, but the self-submissions, you know, that's how I got tapped hard lead, and that was how I got my extra job on GBF with Darren Stein.
You, sir, are no stranger to TV and film. And as an actual member yourself of SAG-AFTRA, you have made credits in various projects, including GBF with Ivana Lynch and Joanna Jojo Levesque, Saving Paradise with William Mosley, and even on an episode of NCIS Los Angeles. How do you feel about getting to work with such well-respected actors and being on such well-known TV shows and movies?
I mean, GBF was a wonderful experience. I knew Jojo from, you know, Get Out, Leave Right Now. Of course, I knew Jojo. And I recognized Zosia Rockmore from Precious when I got on set, because she was in the movie and I loved Precious. So I recognized like some of the people, but not everybody. I had to like Google who some of the people were, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. But I just didn't watch, you know, I didn't watch Pretty Little Liars, so I had no idea who Sasha Peters was. Although it was funny, was Sasha Peters' mom was really cool on set. She would just hang out in the corner with her book while her daughter was working. And you know, if any of the extras were, I was an extra in the movie. If any of the extras, you know, wanted to talk to her, she was totally cool and, you know, not standoffish or anything. So her name was Zizi, and she was actually really cool. But the thing was, that was a labor of love. I mean, what was really cool was we weren't getting paid. It was SAG ultra low budget. But what was really cool But what was really cool was we got a great deal out of it, which was if we got enough screen time, if we came for enough days and got enough screen time, we got a credit in the movie. Mm-hmm. So that was the first time ever in the summer of 2013. So yeah, 2013, first time I ever saw myself on the big screen, even though it wasn't any lines, but you know, saw myself on the big screen. And first time I saw my name in the end credits on the big screen under high school students.
Hey! That's what's up.
And hey, I got to meet Darren Stein. I'm a diehard fan of Jawbreaker. We're still in touch to this day through Instagram. We have mutual friends, so occasionally we run into each other over the years. So yeah, you know, it's awesome. And I'm, you know, if he ever does make the movie musical version of Jawbreaker, I'm always like, I'm a little too old to play a high schooler, but I would love to play a teacher. I would be more than honored to play a teacher in Reagan High. Because yes, that was the name of the high school in Jawbreaker, was Reagan High.
Our days of playing high school students, man, are long gone. They are.
I held out for
the door.
A while, though. I was there. The last time I went in for an 18 to look younger was 31. I lasted a long time. It was for Dear Evan Hansen, the movie.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I didn't get it. But that 31, that was I shaved, you know, everything to look as close as young as I possibly could. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that didn't get the part, but which was funny, was an actor I know socially got the part. So and then I heard through a mutual friend of ours that he didn't even have to audition. It was just an offer. And I was like, well, of course it is. He's bigger than me. He has more credits than I do. And then, of course, Saving Paradise was the first job I booked, because I did Magic 8-Ball in My Life with Asperger's in 2017. Mm-hmm. And I started being represented by KMR, by Gail Williamson, in 2017 as well. And I started going out on auditions for things and here and there. It wasn't consistent, like weekly, but it was every now and then, which I got. You know, I was a member of SAG, but I still had, you know, only credits that were like short films and
something. Yeah, you were trying to build more on your resume and on your credits, which is super important.
Yeah.
Now, you've actually taken your talents of acting, singing, and stand-up comedy, and you've actually turned it into one-man productions. Now, you wrote the play Magic 8-Ball, in which you mix American pop culture, ambition, and public misunderstanding together. You also share a shocking statement that you auditioned for American Idol 9 times. I had absolutely no idea that was the case, and you never made it. What made you decide that you wanted to open up this way through one-man shows, and how did your several attempts at American Idol make you into the performer that you are now?
Well, after my tenure at the Groundlings was done, because I studied there from 2014 to 2015, and at the end of intermediate, the level 2 class, Annie Sertich, who was my final teacher, great, you know, teacher, improv actress. She does commercials and TV, film all the time, works all the time. But she basically sat me down. She was like, here's the thing. You're good at improv. You're great at information, but, you know, with a beginning, middle, end, but you don't do characters the way Groundlings likes characters. Mm-hmm. And I figured, okay, when you're an autistic gay man, I guess it's kind of hard to make that more of a character than what it already is.
Hmm.
So I started developing my one-man show, Magic 8-Ball, My Life with Asperger's. And originally I was going to center it on all the sketch comedy characters that I was starting to work on and develop at the Groundlings. And I was just going to call it my hour-long SNL audition. Then I was taking a meeting with this guy, and I just said, well, I have Asperger's. And he said, I was like, well, what about it? You have Asperger's? That's your story. That's your one-man show. Forget all the SNL stuff. Forget all the sketch. Nobody's going to connect with that. A lot more people are going to connect with Asperger's. He was too much money, so I didn't, you know, work with him for what he was charging. But I did take his advice, and I did run with it, and I did make that the center of my show. And the reason why I wanted to do a one-man show was I was watching an episode of Oprah's Masterclass on the OWN network. And Whoopi Goldberg was on, and Whoopi was talking about how she just wanted to work as an actress, but she wasn't having any luck finding any jobs. So she decided to put together a one-woman show to show everybody what she could do. And that was the beginning of her career, because she put out the one-woman show and it became a big hit. I was done at the Groundlings, and I had a manager and I had an agent, but I was still stuck in a rut and I wasn't having any luck getting any jobs. So that was why I decided to put on the one-man show and really be more open about being on the spectrum, because I wasn't open on the spectrum beforehand with my pursuit for an acting career. When I had previous agents and managers, they weren't selling me as an actor on the spectrum. KMR was the first agency I worked with that sold me as an actor on the spectrum. which I would say is a blessing and a curse. Because did I get some great auditions out of it and some great roles out of it? Yes. But do I only get called in for autistic roles? Yes. Mm-hmm. So part of Hollywood typecasting. So
unfortunately,
that's a whole other battle that you have to go through as an autistic actor, unfortunately, is typecasting. But at the end of the day, I still have to be thankful for everything that Magic 8-Ball did. I mean, I got to tell my story, travel around the country, travel around the world, and meet so many other people on the autism spectrum. It led me to KMR. It led me to the credits of Saving Paradise with William Mosley, who was a true joy to work with on set. He was so lovely and just so kind. And it was an honor to get legendary character actor Paul Dooley, who I knew socially. I got him to play my grandfather in the movie. I saw Paul's one-man show in the summer of 2016 when he was putting it up at the Hollywood Fringe, and I got his assistant Fiona, that was his assistant at the time, Fiona, I got her email, and a year later I invited Fiona and Paul to come and see my one-man show, and Paul wrote a review and published it and said that was one of the best one-man shows I've ever seen. He wrote it was funny, original, honest, and most importantly of all, brave. And then so Paul and I knew each other socially over the years, so when I got the part and I knew that my character needed a grandfather, I said very boldly at the callback, if you pick me, I could get you Paul Dooley. And then after they made me the offer, I immediately called Fiona and said, they're going to call Paul's agency tomorrow. I'm begging Paul to do this. And he did it. Paul's wife, Winnie Holtzman, who wrote the screenplay for Wicked, wrote the book for the musical on Broadway as well. Mm-hmm. Creator of My So-Called Life, one of my favorite shows. She came up to me at the wrap party for Saving Paradise and said, the minute Paul found out it was you, he immediately said yes.
Aw, that's awesome.
It was actually in two different eras, believe it or not. The first six go-rounds were all when I was a teenager. I did it once when I was 16, once when I was 17, when you have to drag your mom kicking and screaming with you because you have to go with a parent or legal guardian.
Really?
Yeah. If you're underage, you have to like have one parent or legal guardian there with you to like be with you. If you're underage, if you're 18, you can come on your own. So when I was 18 and I just graduated high school at that point, I so desperately wanted to win American Idol and be on it in 2008. I wasn't taking no for an answer that year. So I saved up the money and I traveled to three other cities to try and make it happen. I went to Atlanta, Charleston, I went to Miami, and then I went back home to Philadelphia. So yeah, I tried four times in one summer to try and make it, and unfortunately no prevail, didn't make it at any of the freaking cities, much to my frustration at the time. So
they missed out, dude. I'm just saying, they missed out on your talent.
I mean, I'm not the only one. There are tons of successful people like Colby Calais. There are so many successful people that auditioned for American Idol and just like me, didn't even make it past me. I mean, it's a cattle call. Thousands of people come and they only pick hundreds. And what you have to keep in mind is that they're casting a show. I worked with a voice teacher, Adriana McPhee, Catherine McPhee's sister. And I worked with Adriana, and she was like, look, I went on the road with the American Idol casting producers one year. I would want to put people through, but then the person next to me would turn to me and go, we already have 10 girls just like her. We already have 10 guys just like him.
Jeez.
You have to bear in mind, it's not just about your talent or your story. They're casting a show. So one year later, after six tries, I gave up. I was just like, okay, I'm going to move to Southern California. I'm going to be in LA. I'm going to try to make it to the top on my own. I had a couple of things here and there. I met this musician named Chris in college, and we were trying to work together on some things, but that didn't work out. And then I met this producer named Steven, and I was going to be signed to his company and his manager's company at the time. They were going to merge, and I was going to be the first signed artist, but unfortunately that deal fell through. So I had a lot of almost and not quite. After stuff was stalling, I figured, okay, I'm older, my voice is more mature, let me go back and audition for American Idol again in my 20s. However, this time around, it's not the star maker that it once was in the 2000s. At this point, I'm going back in 2014 when it's not really a star maker anymore. And here, I could tell the night and day difference, by the way, from being there in the 2000s versus being there in the 2010s. Really? 2000s, the stadiums are jam-packed with people who are singing everywhere, neurotically, just making sure their song is perfect. There isn't a corner where somebody isn't singing.
Oh, my gosh.
Whereas in 2010s, everybody is just sitting and waiting. Everybody is calmer. And I was like, okay, I get it. Because, yeah, this show is not the make or break star maker that it once was. But my reasoning at the time was still, regardless, it's still good exposure and I could build something from it. So I went in and auditioned for the seventh time. I jokingly call this lucky number seven because this was the first time I did a song called Lately by Stevie Wonder that Jodeci did in the 90s.
Okay.
First time ever I got sent to the second opinion table. I was sent to the second opinion table, and then I sang it one more time, and then they gave me the golden ticket to the next round. So, for the first time ever at 25, I got the golden ticket. I waved, I jumped, I screamed, I called my mom. I was so excited, but unfortunately, I blew it a little too early because I went to the head of the preliminary auditions, and I had to sing again, and my voice was tired. And they said to me, we like your passion, but your voice isn't quite there. Maybe next year.
Oh, my gosh. So you were that close.
That close at 25. I got to the head of the preliminary. And they had the questionnaire by that point. They knew about the Asperger's. I made sure to write that in there. They knew what my story was. They knew that I had tried out six times as a teenager, gave up, and then came back and unnumbed a dream, basically. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I went back and auditioned after lucky number seven. I went back and auditioned two more times. I auditioned in 2015 for their farewell season in 2016. And then when ABC brought it back, I was barely under the age limit. So I went back and auditioned one more time in 2017.
Wow.
And then, neither of those times I even got a call back. Both times it was like, thank you, next. So,
dang.
So lucky, I jokingly call that one lucky number seven. That was the only time where I got close out of the nine tries. Those were three times in my 20s. And now at 36, I'm okay with that because guess what? I have sung at corporate gigs with Jacob Lusk, who was a semifinalist in the first Tyler Jennifer Lopez season, the gospel guy. I've sang at choirs and corporate gigs with him. I've sang at corporate gigs with girls who were on The Voice, where we were all getting paid the same. So that's proof that I'm just as good as any idol or voice person because I got paid at the same corporate gigs they did and got the same amount of money they did. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where it wasn't meant to be. And anybody who's going to pursue this business, you know, is you never know what or when is going to hit.
You really, really, really don't. And that's the interesting part about this business is that not everyone can make it all the way up to the top. It is a very select few. And the reality is not a lot of autistic people are up at the top, as there should be more. It's becoming more prevalent now in this day and age, but we have a long way to go, which is super important. Now, you continued your one-man production journey by premiering the one-man performance, Love and Sex on the Spectrum. You take people on your journey of discovering your sexuality later in life and how you navigate dating and finding love as a gay autistic man. What did this particular one-man performance teach you about your own life journey in terms of your sexuality, and what types of advice can you give to other LGBTQ plus autistic people out there?
So after I toured with Magic 8 Ball my life with Asperger's, I did it for 2 years, 2017 to 2019. I had already done Saving Paradise at that point. And then right after Saving Paradise, I did NCIS Los Angeles as a guest star. It was just like, boom, boom. I got spoiled. But then unfortunately, COVID happened in 2020. The entire industry shut down. And that was when I was lost in the sea of self-tape auditions. So I wasn't getting, nobody was getting in-person auditions anymore. So everything was self-tape. And I was getting one audition after the other, but just wasn't getting anywhere. So I decided to take a risk with my second show and throw caution to the wind. This was my rebellious show. This was my, you know, not wanting to be put in a box anymore. Because look, at the end of Magic 8 Ball, I talk about falling in love with a guy for the first time. Mm-hmm. But I had two directors who were a little more conservative when it came to sexuality and what I could discuss and what I couldn't discuss. And the edgiest I could get with the first one-man show is talking about cuddling with another guy. And for the second show, I worked with the director, Megan Ford Miller. She is a straight woman. I did want to make sure that we did border the line, but we didn't go over the edge. And there were still some people who felt like I went over the edge. But, you know, I wanted to talk about my dating experiences. I wanted to talk about what it was like to come out late, what it was like to discover sexuality at a later age. And just to show that, you know, once again, the stereotype when it comes to autistic people is that we're non-sexual and that, you know, that's a neurotypical thing. That's not a neurodivergent thing. And mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I did that show to make a point to say, hey, we can be just as sexual as a neurotypical human. And mm-hmm. I understood what I was getting into. Neither of my parents watched the show. I understood what I was getting into. And there were some people who loved the first show, but then came and saw the second show and did not like it at all. I mean, the original title was Experiencing Love on the Spectrum. But because I did talk about, you know, sex a little graphically at different parts, she was like, it should be called Experiencing Sex on the Spectrum. So I took a little bit of her note and I was like, well, I'm going to call it Love and Sex on the Spectrum. And also because so many people kept asking me, was I from the Netflix show or was I doing the Netflix show because of Love on the Spectrum?
Yeah, so. People, I remember we were talking about this when we did our first showcase together because I had just shot for my second season with the show. And it was funny because I did not know that you were actually being looked at as a cast member, which is so funny because looking back at it now, because the show premiered almost 3 years ago this year, and it's wild to think that, dang, if George would have been on that first or second season, or even now this recently released third season, you would have had audiences literally lit. I'm not kidding.
I mean, I was interviewed for it, but unfortunately, and I'm friends with one of the casting directors, and he told me flat out that they felt like I came across too, quote unquote, career oriented. So it's like, okay, I get it. You're trying to, you know, stay away from actors. I get it. You don't want actors. But I just had drinks with one of my friends the other night, actually, and he knows one of the producers from Love on the Spectrum. And mm-hmm. You know, I'm like ready to take him up on his offer. Like, yeah, I'm happy to take a meeting. I mean, look, I work as a tour guy now, so we don't even have to put on camera that I'm an actor. We could just say I'm a tour guy for Hollywood bus tours. So no mention of even me being an actor or any of the one man show stuff, because that's what I was talking about in the interview, was all the stuff I was doing with my one man shows. And they were looking for LGBTQ people on the autism spectrum. So I thought
they were.
So I thought that was my shot because of being autistic and LGBTQ. But the career oriented thing was the stop sign for me getting access to be on that show. So, but you know, hey, if they ever want me for a future season, I'm not opposed. I mean, happy to take a meeting, happy to discuss and find out what the rules would be. I mean, I get it. I might not be allowed to talk about being an actor. That's cool. Yeah, I just wanted to push boundaries with that show. And I just wanted to show that, hey, you know, a gay, autistic, it comes in all types. And, you know, it's not a one size fits all kind of spectrum. And look, some people are going to go through their whole life not being sexual, and that's okay. But there are going to be some that are going to want to be sexual. Autistic people do grow up and we do become adults and we have the same wants and needs and desires that any neurotypical human does.
Don't confine us into a box of what you may think that autism is, because it is so much more of a complex world than what people genuinely realize. So with all the performing that you have done over the course of your career, you released your own documentary film last year in 2024 called My Life with Asperger's. This film is both a journey of the present as you bring your life to the stage with Magic 8-Ball across the country and the world with the help of former Motown backup singers, and it's also a journey of the past as you revisit the painful and traumatizing years of being severely bullied and teased for your differences. What made you want to make this film and even include your own life experiences with the addition of personal home videos that a lot of people would never share?
I started working on Magic 8-Ball, My Life with Asperger's in 2016. And that was the same year that I was working on this documentary in tandem.
Really? So,
yeah, it was a it was an eight-year journey, 8-year process making this documentary from start to finish. I had several directors come and go from the project. When I was traveling with the show in 2018 to rural Virginia, and when I was traveling to Edinburgh, and when I was traveling to New York and Pennsylvania, all around the world, I had a filmmaker and a documentarian, Juliana Brudek, follow me as I performed this show around the country and around the world. And then we went back and shot the process of what it was like to create the show at Penny and Crystal, and what it was like for opening night at Hollywood Fringe, and winning awards for the show, and meeting people from all around the world on the autism spectrum, and getting the opportunity to give them a platform to tell their story and have their voices be heard. Because I didn't just want this to be about me. I wanted to make sure that other voices got lifted up and that other voices were shared and heard, because I wanted to show my audience watching this movie, look around you, look around the world. It doesn't matter shape, size, color, gender. Autism comes in all shapes, all sizes, all types, all genders, all sexualities.
That is such a bold way to really describe your life, is by through this show. It was interesting just because I saw some clips just online, and it's interesting just to see how you open up in a way that I never knew that you could, because a lot of people would just sort of kind of keep to themselves about their own childhood and the traumatizing stuff that they went through growing up, in addition to learning more about themselves as they get older and as they grow more mature, more wiser. The way that you open up about even some of the stuff that you go through, like with the fact that you auditioned for American Idol 9 times, never made it except for the lucky number 7, that takes balls to do, and I really applaud you for doing that. And the fact that you were able to even take this Magic 8-Ball performance over the course of touring it all over the world and then taking that and projecting it into this film 8 years later, it's huge, and I give you mad props for that. I would love to actually talk a little bit about another performance opportunity that you and I are both a part of. Epic Players is a neurodiverse theater performing arts company in New York City that opened a branch here in Los Angeles. Now, you and I are both inaugural members of its LA branch and have already performed in 2 cabarets and showcases with Epic since its West Coast launch last year. Epic is now set to show off its 3rd cabaret called Lights, Camera, Cabaret, that we are both a part of, again, that will occur on April 30th, 2025 at the iconic Dynasty Typewriter. What inspired you to try out for Epic, and what has been your favorite part of Epic so far?
Well, it was actually kind of funny. I was actually kind of recruited for Epic.
Really?
Yeah, I was recruited.
Oh my gosh.
I totally didn't expect it. It was totally out of left field. And at that point, I just figured I had nothing left to lose. I mean, because, you know, it's been an interesting, you know, couple of ups and downs. I mean, unfortunately, after getting a guest star on NCIS Los Angeles, where I had a credit at the top of the show and I had a trailer and lines, I thought, okay, this is it. I'm going to steadily work. 2020 is going to be my year. And then, you know, the industry just completely shut down. And then we didn't really recover in 2021 or 2022. And then 2023, we had both the strikes. Mm-hmm. So by 2023, I wasn't happy with KMR, and I wasn't happy with a management company that I'd signed with at the time. So I actually parted ways with both before the strikes. So by 2024, I had just signed with an agent. I was doing this show with this incredible singer. Her name is Katrina Aguilar, and I was her opening act. She was an autistic singer on the spectrum who obviously, similar to my story, Disney helped her connect with the world. So a lot of her cabaret show was Disney songs, like Part of Your World, and, you know, which of course is adorable because the autism, I want to be where the people are. That's, you know, I just want to be part of your world. Obviously, yes, we all get it as autistic humans right here. But but anyways, I was the opening act. And so I did four songs and I got to do a little bit of my jokes in there, a little bit of my patter before each song.
Hey.
Afterwards, Jessica Saul came up to me and came up to Katrina and just said, hey, we're doing this company called Epic Players. I really think that both of you should join.
And, oh, wow.
I guess Katrina decided she wasn't interested, which is all good. But I went ahead and decided to join, figuring, okay, well, I just signed with a new manager. In-person auditions are still a rarity. I don't know how to network with actors now in a post-COVID industry. So I have nothing left to lose.
You and I both are kind of in that same boat where we were both recruited to audition for Epic. I went to actually go see, they had a little comedy showcase back in December of 2023. They were using it to help promote Epic opening its doors. Now, I went to go see one of their New York members perform that I already knew. But funny enough, I was not planning on auditioning. Somehow my contact information got passed over. And initially, after auditioning and making it, I wasn't fully sure if I was going to do it just because it had been such a long time. Unlike a lot of people that we know through Epic, I had stopped singing and acting after college. I was just focused on my career. Getting to join Epic, it's almost like rediscovering a part of you that was never there, and getting to work alongside you and so many other autistic actors, autistic singers. We even have a dancer at Epic, which people don't even know about. And it's so exciting because you just get to be basked in this wonderfulness of talent that this industry is so missing out right now more than anything. And this is also a great time for people to know that, again, our third showcase is going to be coming up on April 30th. Buy your tickets now. They will sell out. Do not wait until the last minute. Do not wait to get them at the door. Get them now. So my last question for you, George, is this. Even though the entertainment industry is starting to open its doors to neurodiverse and autistic talent, there obviously is still a long way to go. What do you wish to say to the entertainment industry in terms of being more inclusive? And what are tips of or pieces of advice that you have for other autistic aspiring actors, singers, and performers who want to break into this industry?
Well, for anybody who wants to break into this industry, if your last name is already the name of an actor who is one of your parents, congratulations, you have it made. You already have a better than 50-50 chance of getting an acting career going if one or both of your parents are in the industry. But for those like me who didn't have family or parents in the industry or a last name for a leg up in the industry, my advice goes as follows. Persistency. Obviously, I was in town for 11 years before I booked my first job, which was a major independent feature film, before I booked my guest star on a major network television show. And there's always going to be ups and downs. I try to warn people, the George Clooney's, the Emma Stones of the world, that's only 2% of actors who are going to get that. So the rest of us are working and then not working. I had NCIS Los Angeles guest star in Saving Paradise, and then I didn't work for 5 years. Thank God I had a stage reading opportunity come to me at the end of last year. So that was my first equity paycheck, and they found me on Instagram. It's a play called 10 Grand, and they're workshopping it. And exciting news, they brought me back for round two. I'm going to be doing the play again next month. So that's an exciting acting adventure I have. So persistency is mainly going to be the name of the game. That would be the advice I would give to anybody. If you know how to make your own content, that's going to really help you. They used to say you can't be a jack of all trades. Now they say get as good at as many things as you can, because the acting opportunities are already sparse and limited as they are. It's not enough for anybody to just be an actor anymore. If you can sing, if you can dance, if you can write, if you can produce, if you can direct. If you have other interests, bring those along with you, because those are not going to hurt you. Those are only going to help you. If there was anything at the strikes, I served as a strike captain during the 2023 strikes over at 20th Century Fox. If there was anything the strikes inspire me to do, it's like, okay, instead of sitting and waiting by the phone for your agent or your manager for the audition or for the opportunity, make the opportunity yourself. Write, produce, direct. Find another way to get into the arena. So yeah, I mean, that's really just the advice I would give to anybody, which is persistency. And there's all different kinds of ways to do it. I mean, look, some people rise up in the ranks through casting director workshops. Great. Some people rise up in the ranks through acting classes or improv schools. Great. I just warn people, be very careful when it comes to acting classes. Some of them have a tendency to get very, very culty. I speak from personal experience. Mm-hmm. So I always warn people, just be careful with acting classes. Some of them have a tendency to become like cults. If all else fails, start making your own material. I wouldn't have gotten Saving Paradise or NCIS Los Angeles had I not wrote a one-man show and got to KMR. So start by writing material. I mean, that's what I'm definitely planning on doing. I'm writing music right now. I have a band, a duo called Coast to Coast with my college friend, Chris.
Nice.
We reunited all these years later. We met in college. It didn't work out. But after Steven and I's, you know, tenure didn't work out, Chris and I reconnected, and now we're a duo, Coast to Coast. We're writing music right now. I just did a short film for the Easter Seals Disability Film Challenge. It's called K-Night. I hope you all will check that out. It's coming out on YouTube soon.
Hey!
My bandmate has a connect to a record label, so fingers crossed they want to sign us. And if they don't, or if it takes time, because I get that things take time, you know, there's a grad school program at USC that is going to be for a master's in playwriting that they just announced is going to be tuition free. So definitely want to do that. And or hey, you never know, 10 grand, which I'm doing the second stage reading for, that could take off into a production, fingers crossed. So lots of possibilities. So that's really my advice to anybody is, look, I'm 36. I moved here when I was 19 to go to college and to start chasing after this. You got to play the long game. If you're in it for instant gratification, this is the wrong business for you. If you're looking to make money, once again, wrong business, because there are going to be years where you don't make money. A lot of those short films that I did through self-submissions on Actors Access, LA Casting, and Now Casting, no money. So, but that was good because that gave me some IMDb credits. That gave me some footage for my reel. The new media project got me my Taft-Hartley, which got me my SAG placement. So,
hey,
everything builds to something, just as long as you're building. And what I always say to people too is, look, it's okay to slow down in your building, and it's okay to take breaks. There have been times in my 16-year trek where I relaxed, where I kind of, you know, wasn't so pedal to the metal and hustling, trying to make a career happen, because I love creating. I love being an artist, but it's always important to have a life balance. Like, you got to enjoy the life moments too.
Enjoying the life while also building up your repertoire, and to not throw in the towel. Keep going. There are so many ways to open doors. If you don't get into a show, create your own show. If this doesn't work out, there's another route. If you're not able to get a record deal, for God's sake, just open your own record company. It's so easy to do. So many ways. And you, sir, are really paving the way for that. And so I can't thank you enough for the great advice that you just gave right there. I think it'll really help a lot of different performers out there, or singers and actors that are also autistic like you and I, to forge their own path and not just fit the mold, but also break the mold. You know, showcases that there's so many ways that you can be successful in this industry. My thanks to George Steves for this impactful and insightful conversation. His documentary film, My Life with Asperger's, is available to stream right now. If you like what you heard on this episode and you want to hear other episodes or stay tuned for future ones, be sure to like, comment, and subscribe to this podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I'm Devin Morrissey, and I'll see you next time right here on Autistically Unapologetic.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Autistically Unapologetic with Devin Morrissey. If you like what you hear and you want to see more, don't forget to rate and subscribe to stay tuned for future episodes. Again, thanks for listening.